All right, everybody, good evening. How are we all doing? Welcome to this talk. I am very happy to introduce and host here at the LSC, Joe Horn Pathanatai, who is, you know, a friend of the LSC, somebody with an absolutely extraordinary background. I am, you know, I always think that I have an unusually international background, but I am miles and miles behind you. Born in London, educated first in Beijing, then in Paris, then at Oxford, then in Cambridge, doing mathematics, okay? You know, I'm an economist, so we economists particularly admire people who are mathematicians, so my hat is off to you. Joe runs a very influential and successful financial and business advisory firm, particularly aimed at firms doing business both in China and in Thailand. And he is very knowledgeable about China. We were having a chat just a few minutes ago, and he helped me dispose of several cliches that I had acquired by, you know, reading the Western press, which, when speaking about China, is not always on the ball. Is that fair to say? He's going to talk to us about China, the experience of the last two decades. And so without further ado, I will hand it over to him. Joe has a presentation. Then I will ask him a question or two to satiate my own curiosity. And we will open it up to everybody in the room so we can have a good Q&A session. All right? So, Joe, welcome to the LSC. We're delighted to have you here. And the floor is yours.
Thank you.
So, thank you very much. I'm really honored to be here today. Thank you to LSC and, you know, Dean Andres in particular for inviting me to have a, it's a new decade, and I would like to actually take a decade-long view, you know, on how China is moving, and the challenges that we'll see in the 20s. I'm going to cover four things. The first is the economic angle, and why do I start with the economic angles? Because the economy in China, you know, is the one thing that really can topple empires, and so it's, you know, very important that we have the eye on that ball, because the Chinese leaders are having their eye on that ball. The second one, we're going to talk about politics, policies, and also policy making. How the Chinese have been thinking about policy making through the ages, you know, two decades ago, one decade ago, and in the decade to come. The third, and partly because we're also sitting in the UK now, talk about geopolitics. And again, I'd like to take a kind of a decade-long view on this, so I wouldn't be covering too much stuff like, the part one of the trade agreement, the trade war agreement. However, you know, I'll be looking at the things, the shifts that are going to happen in the next 10 years. And finally, I'd also like to cover a little bit about society and societal issues that are going to be facing China very soon. Not necessarily in the 20s, but we're talking like one, two decades ahead. Also, if any of you have any questions at any time, just please feel free to jump in. Because it's at the SPP, so I'm going to focus a little bit more on the policy and the policy making side. But again, it's important to understand how it all ties in, and so I will be spending a good part of my first section on the economics. Very simplistically, this is how you can see the Chinese economic model through the decades. 90s, effectively, it's like riding a bike uphill. And you basically have to, there were many, many, many problems, massive problems. 40, 50 million people unemployed from state-owned enterprise reform. Non-performing loans on a par nearly with Southeast Asia, you know, about 40% non-performing loans. Inflation, all these problems. And the way to solve basically every problem is grow. You grow out of them. 40 million, 50 million people unemployed, well, they found new jobs. It took some time. Some places had 40% unemployment for a while, and they managed to the private enterprise picked up the slack. In about 2002, 2003, China grew to a point that it became so big that it affected world prices. Those were the years, if you recall, where the Nokia hand phones went from being very expensive to being like less than $100. And now it's like $10, right? But that's because China manufactured it. So anything China made became cheap. Anything China needed, oil, went through the roof. So oil, that was, I think it was 2003, the year where oil went from 20 to 200. And so then the model, so China still had to grow because it still had 40% and non-performing loans. It still had to grow, but it couldn't grow too fast, right? So, for example, take non-performing loans. They didn't actually do anything particularly smart with these non-performing loans. They just put them aside, made sure that the new loans were better made, that you didn't create any new ones, and they just put them in a bucket, and these were called the four state-owned asset management corporations, and they left it there. And it started off at 40%, but the loans were growing at 25%. So the next year went down to 32, the following year 25, the following year 18, etc. And so within a few years, non-performing loans basically were no longer an issue. But now, it couldn't grow like at any rate. It had to grow within this very narrow band. So it's a bit like you're a rocket coming down into the back to Earth. And so you have that 2% can't go above, so much and below so much. There's a little 2% safe zone, and all of your instruments are faulty. So the central government had no idea what the real growth rate was in any of these provinces. And in fact, until probably might still be the case. I mean, if you add the official GDP numbers of all the provinces, you get a different number from the national one. Normal. Then what happened in 2008, the American financial crisis, global financial crisis hit. China then came out that year in 08, 09, with the largest bailout of any country per GDP. 4 trillion yuan to be used over 2 years. Now, what hasn't been realized often is that over that same 2 years, the commercial banks in China increased their loan portfolio by 18 trillion yuan. So you had effectively a bailout of 22 trillion yuan, only 4 of which came from the government. The remaining 18 came from the banks. And at that time, I was like, this is crazy. China used to be about 150% total debt to GDP. And that's when it basically got on this effectively unstoppable trajectory, which has led it to where it is today at 300. And it's finding it incredibly difficult to lower that. And 300, people say, America has 300. Yes, but the cost of debt in America is much lower. And then you say, but they have $3 trillion of reserves. First of all, foreign reserve can't help you fix the domestic economy. You might as well just print money. Secondly, that's around about what they pay in interest every 18 months. So it's the numbers actually are so big that the debt problem became the major issue. And that basically, by 2010, so all through the teens, China was on this unstoppable cycle. And so you have too much credit, which was accumulated over far too short a time, and which is far too expensive.
This private debt?
All in. Mostly private. But even the government debt, we'll see, also went up. And will continue to go up as they nationalize a lot of the problems.
Is private debt issued by companies, and on the other side of that debt is?
So it's by banks.
Banks.
Most, two-thirds of which are state-controlled. Well, so state-owned and the remaining are state-controlled. But the other side are often private enterprise. So both state-owned and private, so it's a big mixture. And then everyone, you know, is looking at this new China now. So, oh, you know, there's Alibaba, there is WeChat, there's Huawei, all these big, exciting companies coming out of China, and there are. Unfortunately, the banks are not exposed to them. Alibaba doesn't borrow money from Bank of China, right? They don't need it. So the banks are exposed to old China with all this excess capacity and with all the problems. Another problem that has come from this crackdown, you know, Xi Jinping, one of the things that got him very popular was this crackdown against corruption. People loved him for it. But the problem is now you have 90 million people because he locked away a million of them. But that million that he locked away has led to the 90 million who are still working to basically not do anything. And we're seeing you know, the effects of that in everyday life, that where, you know, people are deciding to, you know, the officials are deciding, let's just not do something like that, you know, because to do so would be a risk. So the big question for this decade is, can China deflate this credit bubble? And, you know, can it actually push the reforms that it really needs? So the problem is, effectively, you're in this spiral of, you know, you need debt to create GDP. At its worst, you need a $5.5 of debt to create $1 of GDP. The GDP, how do you create it? You go create capacity. Okay, then capacity, well, what do? You've got to build stuff. Infrastructure. So infrastructure. I was in Chengdu, massive city in the west of China, and it had the biggest interconnection link between Europe and China rail link. That was where a third of all trains on the China-Europe trains departed from. And I asked the mayor, I said, hey, like, so how many trains depart every year? He said, 1,000. I'm like, wow, that's like 3 a day. That's a lot of trains. Then I asked him, how many, like, containers per train? 44. I'm like, hang on a minute. 44,000. That's 3 boatloads. So they built thousands of kilometers of rail to satisfy 3 boatloads of containers. Right? So, I mean, sure, you always say there's a strategic angle to it, and there's always a strategic angle to anything the Chinese do. But, you know, it's a lot of rail for effectively not a lot of containers. So, how to fix it? So, the 2010s were when this problem was created. And 2020 is basically when we're going to have to fix it. So, 3 things. The first one is, I call it the 4 Ds. It's effectively deleverage, decapacity, de-stock, and de-cost. It's one of the landmark kind of policies of structural supply-side reform. So that's the first one. Reducing capacity, reducing excess capacity, which is huge. Like if you look at steel, for example, 1.3 billion tons of steel capacity in China, they use probably 800. Then you're going to ask yourself, well, what is the point of getting the iron ore from Chile, the coking coal from Australia, the oil from Middle East, all heavy, cheap stuff that you have to ship all the way across the world, go to China, make steel, which is also cheap and heavy, which you then have to go and re-export. That makes no sense. Now, so that 600 million tons of excess capacity, which has come down a little bit, just to give you an idea, Japan, which is the second largest country in the world, has 150 million complete total capacity. So, like, their excess capacity is like 3 times what Japan has. And Japan is number 2 country in the world for steel. Right. So there's a huge, and cement is like 3 billion tons. They use 2.4. By 2045, it's going to go down to 800. By Chinese estimates. Right. So, you know, we have a lot of capacity that needs to be dealt with. Bank leverage, the deleverage, is a, you know, it's an existential thing. They cannot not do it. And they realize, and that's one favorable, really good thing, and I'm coming to that in a minute, is that actually the government has finally realized that the problems of the banking sector. And at that time, when I was when they were building up, you know, from 150 to 300, I was meeting with a friend who runs this big bank in China. I was saying, why are you like kind of destroying the banks to save the economy? He said, well, right now the economy is bad, the banks are good. We use the banks to help the economy. Later, when the banks are bad, we'll fix the banks. So okay, can't kind of argue with that. But this problem, for the longest time, was overlooked until there was this meeting mid-2018. I think it was, I can't remember, it was June or April. Where it was this small leading group meeting where all the main, the top seven guys, like anyone had anything to do with it, was there. And they basically made, you know, banking sector the number one, two, three priority of the government. Sure, you have, you know, poverty reduction, you have environment, you have a lot of other things, but that meeting was a meeting in which they were like, realize, oh, you know, banking sector is the one thing that where this could come apart. And of course you have NPLs, which the recorded number is like 1 to 2%. And so you see this one here is the price to book value of the big four banks. And then you can see how it moves inversely, right? So there is a big correlation. And as you can see here, these are banks from all over the world. K-Bank, a Thai bank, we have European banks, American banks. There is a correlation, very, very tight one. You can check, even Deutsche Bank fits this, right? But you have a very tight correlation between price to book and ROE. Well, this shows here, all these Chinese banks are way below. Why? The market doesn't believe this number. Now, if you backtrack using
the NPL number.
They don't believe the NPL number. And if you actually backtrack that, make assumptions on loss rate, make assumptions on what the earnings should have been, what the NPL should have been, you end up at, depending on which bank you're talking about, 15, 20% NPL rate, some maybe 10. Which is, well, the good news is it's manageable. We've done it in Thailand before. NPLs, they're like, you know, I started working during the Asian crisis, actually fixing the Thai banks, and the three levels where NPLs hit, and it does at 15-20%. It's not systemic yet. You don't. So long as there's not a liquidity run, the banks can keep on going forever. Now, NPL is only part of the problem. There's this unholy trinity of NPLs, cost of funds, and liquidity. All right, so the NPLs tend to create a run on it. So long, if people stop believing there's an NPL problem, there will be a run on the bank. And before there's a run on bank, the cost of funds go up. And this problem affects the smaller banks most. Okay, so the big four are fine. The smaller banks are not. And the smaller banks are really squeezed now in China. But the good news is the smaller banks, and they're not systemically relevant yet. Now, how to fix it? So first, time. Time is important because at 20% NPL rate, if you can drag it on, you can drag the time needed to fix the banks, you actually never need to raise fresh capital. You can use the earnings of the banks to fix the NPL problem. Second thing, expertise. Over the past year or so, they've been placing, as deputy governors, as deputy mayors, a lot of bankers and regulators in government positions so that people running the provinces overseeing, because the provinces are where these problems are, the people running the provinces would be more knowledgeable about the banking sector. Coordination. They have this leading group, which is a party. It's basically this issue is a party issue now, so it transcends, and it's at a very senior level. So it over, you know, it goes across the heads of a lot of governors, so you can actually push down orders. It doesn't always happen in China, but every now and then they get something like this, which is so important that they need to have a coordinated approach. So then a coordination. And the SWAT, they actually literally have a SWAT team of accountants and bankers who are on 24-hour notice. And they can, fly in and basically, if there's a bank about to die, they'll fly in and fix it overnight. Next morning, you wake up, bank's fixed. So, emergency kind of response team. And they've done that with a number of banks, smaller banks that were kind of on the last breath.
Who eats the losses?
Shareholders. So it's actually not a... So the shareholders get wiped out. The question remains that will the interbank, because we're not there yet, will the interbank get hit? And I think they're staying away from that for the time being, because that then creates a possibility of a domino effect, so they want to keep that. And they'll find a local state-owned enterprise to come and hold the shares, basically stabilize it. The depositors are always made full. The corporate deposit is not necessary. So you get a notice on the side of the bank saying, whatever your bank account number was at your old bank, just go to ICBC and same bank account. And automatically, that just creates a situation where no one withdraws the money because they know it's with ICBC. So that's a fix. They have only worked in the past and until now because the number of banks failing has been small. They've also worked because there's been a belief in the rising tide that I can always take this bank, I can always take these assets, these non-performing loans. It's okay because the asset value will increase, right? And so there's been this belief amongst the bankers and the central bankers and the corporates who are asked to bail them out and the market as a whole is that, I can, there's no, at most I'll wait a bit and, I'll get it at the end. But, if that assumption is no longer true, it would be an interesting situation how the fixes will work going forward.
Are the NPLs mostly concentrated within the private enterprises or state?
Yeah, mostly private. Yeah, the state, so far the state's doing okay. So what's going to happen in the 20s on the economic side? First of all, things are going to get more balanced. There's no longer this kind of massive imbalance of trade deficit and then investment deficit. It's, the investment's going to come, it's all going to be some years positive, some years negative, and it's all going to trend, around zero. Also, an interesting thing is there's going to be less largesse. So this idea of building massive infrastructure, which may or may not be used because it's good for China Construction Corp, I don't think they can do that anymore. They can't. That go-to solution that has worked for 30 years is no longer available. Why? Because budget deficit of 4%. They wouldn't even get into the euro. Once they got in, then they could stay in. Once they're in, they could stay in. But at 4%, they wouldn't get in. Right? And then this is...
Most European countries have budget deficit 4%, and I got in anyway.
This is the debt to GDP. Central government debt to GDP. Right. Sorry. It's not. It's central government plus, I think, local government, but not including the Ministry of Rail. Another interesting.
What is the currency denomination of that debt?
Mostly yuan.
Mostly yuan.
Okay. Oh, sorry. You mean of the government debt?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure, actually. Yeah.
Because that's what gets you into trouble, right? If you borrow in a foreign currency,
and
you get into a crisis, your currency devalues. Suddenly, the carrying value of that debt skyrockets.
Yeah.
If it's in your own currency, who cares, right?
Yeah, there is that argument. Another argument is I'm sure the Chinese would rather owe money to a foreigner than to their own people.
Yes, although you have to owe money to a foreigner in your own country,
So I'm not sure, actually. My guess is probably a mix, because they do have these, I think they call panda bonds or something, or local yuan denominated, but not a lot overseas. So most of the overseas circulating debt is going to be in dollars and euros a little bit. But I think that there's also a lot of debt which is held by the banks themselves, and that would be in yuan. This one's interesting. So this is the working population in China. And as you can see, as it was increasing rather rapidly here, the wages stayed subdued. And then as it started inverting, inflection point, Here, it just picked up. And now, working population is actually decreasing. So, no longer cheap. All right, so they're going to have to figure out ways of making it, squaring the circle there. Because a lot of things that they've also relied on was, this pool of cheap labor. It's also going to be more international. What you think is international China is actually not that international yet. This is merely the beginning, the very beginning of China coming out to the world. And it's the second economy of the world. It's normal that these second economies of the world own 9% of, Mercedes and Volvo or whatever. That's a normal thing. This is the stock, FDI stock, in all these countries, which all these countries think. And now Thailand, for example, for the first time this year, China overtook Japan in terms of new FDI coming into China. And we have Trump to thank for that because of the trade war. So they relocated. They basically put a Thai flag on a lot of these Chinese products. But take Thailand. This is China. This is Japan. FDI stock. Of course, they've had 40, 50 years to do it. But the point is, we're looking at it. China's going to be, over the next years, China's going to be catching up here. There's going to be a lot more China, for better or for worse. Now, the good news is that it's going to be for better, I think, because two things. One is there's going to be more international people, internationally educated people in China who get into positions of management. So far, we don't really have very many Western educated. Actually, the most senior Western educated person in China today, Yang Jiechi, Politburo member, LSE educated. Yeah. LSE had a big front start from the other universities because in the 1970s, Zhou Enlai had a chat with Heath and they said, look, we want you to educate our best and brightest. And then he was like, yeah, where do you want to go? Like Oxford came and said, too imperial, too bourgeois. Uh-huh. LSE at the time was outright communist. So they were like, and it was red. So like, okay, let's come to LSE.
Heavy infrastructure.
Yeah.
Anything but bourgeois.
Another thing. Another thing which is going to happen more and more, and we're going to have to just get used to it, is that China is going to start dictating standards, industry standards first. For the next decade, it will be industry standards. After that, who knows? And finally, as a result of this and this and this, and a little bit these two, there's going to have to be more reforms. There are going to be more reforms, not because Xi Jinping dictates it, not because the party thinks it's a good thing to do. There are going to be more reforms because there is no choice. They cannot rely anymore this decade on this thing that has worked for the last three. They're going to have to reform, which is a good thing. Okay, now, politics and policymaking. There are basically three axes, and I call it the yin and yang because I don't want to make a judgment on whether it's good or bad. Okay? But you have the, in the past, I'd say in the 90s, it used to be here. Long-term thinking, more central, but also a bit a little bit more central, but also a lot of local input, right? And, mostly expert. There's always been this kind of dichotomy in China between expert versus red. And I'll go into each of these three dimensions. But what's happened now is we've gone all the way to the other side. It's mostly knee-jerk reaction now. It's mostly centrally dictated, and it's kind of mostly red rather than expert. Now, here's the red versus expert, what happens? And so, this is seek truth from facts, which is actually originally a Mao quote, and then it became a Deng quote. And basically, you start off with, and this is just say economic policy, you start off with the main economic think tank, CAS, China Academy of Social Sciences. So it starts with the think tank. Then it goes on to the research center, the government's research center, DRC. Development Research Center. And then they come out with, okay, this is what we need to be doing, the think tank reports, you know, grassroots feedback and everything, and this is what we need to be doing. Then it goes to the NDRC, which is the former planning bureau. The NDRC, National Development and Reform Commission. Then NDRC goes, okay, these are the policies, but we're not so sure whether we should do A or B. Let's do an experiment. So Chongqing, you do A. Tianjin, you do B. And then, so they do experiments. And then the experiments come back. One is good, one is bad. Then the good one goes into the ministries, into the provinces, and down into the cities. Or it doesn't. It doesn't work out and go back again. Loop again. And this is the basically the way they've been doing this expert model for a long time. And it's worked very well. Then you have, this basically is Chinese for plucked from thin air. And then you just basically get the policy. And you know, there are policies that have been instrumental to China's success as an economy today, which could not have been done in any other way other than being plucked from thin air. And for example, it's the Shenzhen model. Like, you know, Deng one day said, yeah, we can have one country, two systems. Why not? Like, everyone was like, well, okay, let's give it a go. And then it flipped back here and everyone started, you know, and a lot of the market reforms were done on a very much on a kind of a expert basis. You know, they had people and they had this, you know, they had a bureau in the 90s called the Experimentation Bureau, where they just like experiment stuff. Very, very, you know, dynamic. It was the 90s were a fantastic time to be in China. Really dynamic. So bold, the reforms that they made went against anything that they would have studied in the LSE or at Harvard. Because all these guys, they were educated in the West. And they came, you know, people, you know, Chicago School would say, you could never have state-owned and, a competition under state ownership. So they said, well, why don't we do this? We split the one bank that we have into four, and then we tell each of the bosses that whoever does the best becomes minister. And that was all it took. State-owned competition to the death. It was fight to the death. That's all they had to do. And this is kind of this outside-box thinking that we were having back then. And so Shenzhen model would not have worked. You have the market reform. And then you have stuff like SOE reforms, which sometimes are this way, sometimes are that way. Now it's kind of coming more to the red. It used to be a little bit more to the expert. Second is central versus local. This is an old Chinese saying. This is not something under the communists. Old Chinese saying. And, you know, it rings very true. And because there is a very clear division between what the central government says and what actually gets done, always has been, under the empire and today. Because here, they do just the policy direction. These guys would actually come up, the provincial leaders would come up with an implementation method. So this is the policy, this is how we're actually going to implement it in our province, because each province is different. They're not going to say, you do this over the whole of China. They say, this is what we need to get done. And then the province says, okay, this is how we get it done here. And then the actual guys getting it done are the mayors. So we get this. And the local government are the guys getting it done. Now, a good example, which is also very much a result of the trade war, is that right now a lot of universities have been told, no foreign textbooks, no Western textbooks, right? You know, it's reaction, right? Well, the professors say, well, they said no textbooks, but they didn't say no articles. So, and then long versus short. So you have, for example, I take the case of the environmental reforms. You have, on the one hand, there was this very long-term planning. My brother actually did a lot on that. And Chai was in China in the early 2000s, dealing exactly with this, and they had these long-term five-year, 10-year, 20-year plans. And you can see they went from a vice ministry-level entity to a ministry-level entity to a full ministry, which gets representation in the state, what do you call it, the state council. And then they increase and change the whole model. So this is, you could see the long-term thing. But then on the other hand, you have short-term, so you have this smog. See, this is Gary Locke, American ambassador to China a few years back. And he started publishing the PM 2.5 number just where in his ministry, in his embassy. And everyone started paying attention to PM 2.5. Before that, no one knew about it. No one knew about it. And then everyone started being conscious. And there was a number every day. You know, there was a number. Like before, people knew there was it was a bad day or a good day, but now there's a number. And then it happened to be a convenient way to solve the 4D problem. So D capacity, they just decided, okay, we'll just use the yardstick for deciding who stays and who goes in terms of D capacity is environmental. And it happened, just so happened, that it was the private enterprises that tended to have the lower environmental standards, and therefore they got wiped out under this decapacity. So so now you go to Beijing now, skies are blue. So you see the mixture of the long and short in policy making. Now then we have here a case study of what happens when the policy making really works. And this is a great example because, you know, we're all impressed about how China is really leading the game in terms of innovation. But it there was also a big mixture of you know, local and central, of long-term planning. This one is mostly long-term planning. But their ability to allocate resources long-term was, you know. So you have, for example, the CAS, and also a bit NDRC, would allocate, this university you do quantum. So, you know, this Chinese professor called Pan Jianwei was the first guy to do quantum entanglement between land and satellite. He started, it was in 97 he got his budget. Let's you know, there were no quantum computers in 97. There were barely any computers in 97, right? And there they decided. And the aha moment for the Chinese on the innovation, the why we need to be innovative, is actually Thailand. Because in the early 90s, they were wondering whether, well, you know, maybe we can just do like the Tigers. They're doing pretty well. We just buy here, assemble, and sell. Buy here, assemble. Thailand was very rich back then compared to China. And they were looking up to Thailand. And then came the Asian crisis, started in Thailand. Then they thought, and that was 97. And they were like, yeah, let's do our own innovation. So 97 was when a lot of these things started. So that's research allocation. They will use their policy tools to support or dissuade certain, or even block. You know, why is Google blocked in China? Why is Facebook blocked? Well, to protect their own guys, but also to have favorable policies to help them long term. They have the ability to allocate market, and that's a huge thing if you're in the innovation business. To know that so long as you're the best, and you don't even have to be state-owned, you can be a private company. So long as you're the best, someone will use your stuff. So the market thing, you know, like right now BYD is selling its electric cars to Shenzhen as taxis. All the taxis in Shenzhen are electric now. And finally, entire supply chain of financing, from angels to VCs, private equity, stock markets, you know, foreign money, local grants, everything, all there. Everything you need is all there. And it, you know, this creates what has created China's innovation today is this. On to geopolitics. So everyone is talking about BRI. Everyone, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? It's happening. And it's going to continue to happen for the next 20, 30 years. And why? Because they need it. They need the BRI. They can't. They need to be able to expand the current base of building stuff. They can't. There's nothing left to build in China. They have to do it. But why now? Well, they're richer now, you know, both in terms of GDP per capita and in terms of, you know, foreign reserves. The economic fundamentals we addressed already, and there is this belief of a policy stability because you have, you know, a leader who has stated that he wants to stay a long time. So people who are their counterparts, I'm, you know, UK government, I'm the Thai government, I'm going to be pretty comforted, a little bit more comfortable in the fact that at least he says he wants to stay a long time. And, you know, it's not going to have a, you know, five year, in 5 years' time he's going to be out and his successor is going to change the policies. Now, the question is, what do they really want to export? it's actually not capacity. First and foremost, it's capability. They have these machines that build things. These machines are called China Rail Construction, China Construction Corp, China Engineering. You know, all these companies are there, and they build thousands of kilometers of rail and road, and they need to... You can't put them aside for 3 years, tell them, just wait here for three, we'll come back 3 years later. It doesn't work, so you have to keep them working. It doesn't matter if they use the steel from China or not. That's secondary. What's most important is that they use the companies from China. But if they use Chinese steel, all the better. Finally, it's actually geopolitical clout. Clout is very far down in the list of priorities. And then you have a few other benefits, which is, you know, resources. They need resources, always need resources. And they want to promote the RMB as a credible alternative to the US dollar. They've had problems. The first one has been always a problem of execution. This is often in the case of China, you know, big policies and big, you know, centrally drawn up plans. And then it comes and it falls flat on execution. There's also poor coordination between, you know, so you'd have one entity pushing one thing, another entity pushing another thing, the government in the middle not really being too sure what's going on. Right, actually, you know, there's also corruption in the middle. So, you know, the government officials on the other end are pushing for something and saying, "Oh, we want this." So, it's a mess of a coordination. And finally, it's also a very bad PR. The Chinese have been pretty poor at PR. If you think about it, you know, I'm coming. I'm a neighbor. I knock on a neighbor with a big house. I knock on your door and I say, "Hey, you know, I'd like to rebuild your kitchen. You look at my kitchen; it's very good. I'll build your kitchen for you." Right, and you know what? Like with this new kitchen, you're gonna be able to eat better. It's gonna be cheaper. Your kids are gonna be more healthy, right? And by the way, I'll pay for it. You pay me back in 20 years, right? Who would say no? You say, please do my bedroom as well, right? No. But the Chinese, they don't do that. Well, they come, they knock on your, they bang on your door, and they get all their friends to start knocking and say, hey, by the way, the Chinese are coming. You better say yes to this. Okay, they're banging on your door. And then they're going like, oh, I have 5,000 years history of building kitchens. And you're going, oh, gosh. And I'm going to link your kitchen. First of all, I'm going to build everyone's kitchen in this neighborhood. And I'm going to link them all with the great data, Silk Road of data. You're going, whoa. I said, no, thank you, right? And that's a PR thing. I mean, totally, honestly, they should be much better at this, at figuring out the PR side. And so they've been getting a lot of pushback, and which they deserved. And now they're going on a new BRI. So there's a new improved BRI, BRI 2.0, which is clean, so there are these anti-corruption officers checking you're not corrupting anything. Green, so they're going to give you the best stuff. It's not like, you know, secondhand excess capacity. And untrapped, you're not going to have any debt traps. Actually, on the debt trap, also bad PR. And like, people don't realize Sri Lanka, which is where everyone is, Sri Lanka owes Japan just as much as it owes China. Same. No one talks about the Japanese. It's just much quieter, and you know, right? No one talks about a Japanese threat. And you know, I can go in for hours on why that's the case. Now, what is it that they like when they search for these partners? They like rich. Okay, they like big, they like friendly, and they like stable. And you know, I took a look at this, all 60 plus countries that are in the quote unquote BRI list. There is not one of them that satisfies all four. Actually, the UK was pretty close for a moment, right? And you know, on the kind of friendly side, sadly, Hong Kong happened, and there's nothing you can do about that. It's naturally going to end up on two sides of this issue, and you know, on the stable side, they also used to think, you know, changing governments is normal. But then Brexit came. You know, and you know, they only just got over, you know, come to terms with Brexit. And now you have Mexit. And now they have no idea what to think of the English anymore. So now England's here. So what beyond the trade war? These are all, you know, thinking 30 years. Huh? There's trade war. And okay, we're in a bit of a lull. But there's also going to be a tech war. And that's being waged now. And, you know, you have research grants to the U.S. being canceled, researchers being sent back home, vice versa is happening, this whole no foreign textbooks thing, right? And, you know, but tech wars are going to be so difficult to really engage in effectively. Then you have the finance war, which also has started, you know, and it can get really ugly if the Americans start blockading the yuan and the Chinese, you know, let's dump $100 billion of treasury bonds. So it could get quite ugly, the finance war. Sooner or later, though, I think they're going to get into an ideological war about this is the China ideology versus the Western ideology. And my ideology is going to be much more appealing to my neighbors, to the, you know, the poorer countries in the world. You know, I'm going to be, and you know, they're still formulating that, what the, you know, the package is, but it's going to come. And big question is, you know, will there be a proxy war? And the only thing that I have, which is a little bit kind of, you know, coming from Thailand, we're a little bit worried about that, is that the proxy war ain't great if you're a neighbor. And it tends to be somewhere close by, number one. And number two, if you look at the Chinese military buildup, its military buildup is not meant to, you know, attack America. It's not there to attack America. But aircraft carriers and things like that, these are, you know, 20th century equipment. But it's the kind of stuff you need in a proxy war. So that, just mentioning. Now, why? Why is it happening now? I just played a little bit with the numbers. These are purely our own, just very basic assumptions. But what is interesting is, okay, you're assuming, you know, China growth is actually going to taper off. So it's not going to be at 6%, nor 5%, nor 4%. It's going to keep on going down. You know, basically 2% a decade is what it's used to doing, right? So, but, you know, often you have these things, and it's steady state, quote unquote. You know, China overtakes American total GDP by sometime in the 2030s. Now, this is a scenario where China never takes over America. And the difference between the two is 0.33% growth every year. It's not, you don't need to kill Chinese growth by 2%. You just need to kill it by 0.33% every year. And then look at it. They've done it. And sure, it's impacted American growth, right? Well, it's impacted American growth, but the important thing is we're here at 4%, right? Here we're at 5.2. The delta is what matters. And the Chinese are still going, you see, America's growing at 1.8%. You see, it's hurting them as well. Yes, but it's hurting you more. And that was the whole point. They changed the game. The Americans changed the game. They don't care about total growth anymore. They care about squeezing the delta. Now, and another problem that the Chinese are going to have is that there are, you know, when push comes to shove, they're not against America alone. They're against, effectively, the entire rich world and a lot of non-rich countries, which are naturally will, if they had to pick. And take Canada as an example. Canada, super friendly to America, to China. All it took was this one, you know, can you please arrest this lady? And they immediately, overnight, flipped to America. You know, it's very easy to tell, like, and there should be no, you know, doubt about that, that if push comes to shove, most of these countries will flip to American side. Right? Now, for us, and we're dealing with this in Thailand, is that, sure, on the one hand, the rise of China, but there's also the decline of the U.S. And that's just as scary, right? And we in Thailand are feeling it, where, you know, they're becoming an increasingly unreliable partner. And that's, you know, how is that going to play out in the future? So it's not just about how we handle China, it's how we handle the U.S. What role will Europe play? A big deal about whether or not China will, you know, rise or not rise, it has to do with, you know, the rest of Asia and Europe. And there's also the question, like, hey, you know, does China even really want to have leadership, quote-unquote, you know, leadership on a geopolitical side? You know, are they not more comfortable actually having America play that role, you know, policeman of the world, et cetera, and they just basically lie back and, you know, have it easy. But, you know, what will they ask for as they become bigger and bigger? Finally, household debt at nearly 60%. Actually, I think it's at 60 now. It's like 59 point something, right? taking into account that a 60% in China is effectively a 70% anywhere else in the world because there's less safety net, is very high. I mean, so this whole concept that Chinese have great savings and households have great savings is no longer true. Also no longer true is the fact that, you know, you have a government that is very, you know, very lowly indebted, 42%. But you have to add the local government funding vehicles, which is about 30 plus, maybe 40%, of which the government probably has to take about half of that. So we're talking over 60%. Now, that's more than Germany, by the way. It's not low. And more than Germany, and paying a lot more to service that debt. Right? So no more this idea that you can keep on being carefree and rely on savings, that's gone. Another thing which is gone is the population dividend. Right? You have working population which has started to dip. Migration, net migration, that's a few hundred thousand people every year, by the way. That's a lot, and it's the best. The best Chinese leave. Right? So a lot come here, actually. You also have the, you know, this is the new babies. It's covered here, but they introduced a two-child policy. The numbers went up for 1 year. And then they all decided that was an awful idea, and it started going down again. So it went straight down. It's been plummeting since. And then, you know, urbanization is going to taper off. It's at 60% now. It's been basically a percent a year. Within the next decade, we'll see a slowdown of the urbanization rate. So with that, I will end there and leave it to you.
Thank you very much, sir. So I'm going to take the liberty to ask two quick questions, and then we will open it up to the floor. My first question is going to be one that I will ask putting on my hat as a macroeconomist and a development economist. One of the few, you know, history has proven that we macroeconomists don't know a lot. We tend to get it wrong. But one assertion that most of my colleagues would make with some confidence is that if you take a developing country, and China is still a developing country, which grows very quickly for a long time, and which accumulates a lot of debt over, you know, the cycles that you described very well, at some point that country is going to have a financial crisis. Thailand did, every country in East Asia did. Of course, I come from Latin America, you know, we have a PhD in that. We invented financial crises, but that's also true of much of Eastern Europe, it's true of much of Southern Europe as it was developing. You know, we didn't think the U.S. could have one. The U.S. had one. The U.K. had one. So if China is like every other country in the world, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, at some point China will have a financial crisis. That's the negative view. The positive view is, well, it's not quite right because all the economies you mentioned were really economies in which the authorities had little control over the financial system. China is different because in the end the government can pick up the phone and tell the banks what to do. That may or may not be true. Do you subscribe to the first school of thought, which says China is doomed to have a crisis, or to the second school of thought, which says there are enough levers in there for the Chinese government to avoid this?
I think they wouldn't be so worried about the financial crisis if they themselves didn't think that a financial crisis was a very real possibility, which is the reason why they have, you know, this leading group, which is the reason why they have the SWAT teams, why they're, you know, introducing a lot of reforms in the banking, the way banks are run. Nice. So I think that, you know, personally, I started my career with a nice big financial crisis. So I see crises maybe where others necessarily don't. But the important thing is that actually I believe the government themselves believe that there is a very real possibility of a crisis, and that's why they're doing what things they're doing.
Okay. So the macroeconomists are not entirely wrong.
Not entirely wrong. Okay.
Now, let me refer you to one of the last slides you put up there, in which you had trade war, you know, little bubbles. Then you had potentially a financial war, a tech war, and then a real war. I think the trade war has been mostly hype, in the following sense. You know, when you read the FT, it says, oh, tariffs of 10% or 20% apply to 60 billion. You know, to the regular reader, man or woman, that sounds like a lot of money. But given that we're talking about countries like the US and China, where the GDP is in the tens of trillions, 10% of 60 billion is not a lot of money. So the real impact of the trade war is mostly not really a trade impact, it's really a psychological impact. You know, if you look at all the estimates by the Goldman Sachs and JP Morgans of the world, where you really get a big bang is when you get finance into the picture, or when you get, you know, geopolitics into the picture. So if the trade wasn't a big deal, and you did show a sort of a slippery slope, what would it take for that somewhat hyped, not quantitatively big war, a trade war, to morph into one of the others, call it a more severe financial destabilization, call it a tech war, and I'd be curious to know exactly what that means. What sorts of scenarios do you have in mind that would take us down that slippery slope?
It all depends really on two sides, and that's one side, which is Trump. So it's very difficult to really predict anything.
That very reliable leader of the West. Yes.
That said, I think the important thing to realize is that even if we end up having a different leader in charge in America, it doesn't necessarily mean the Chinese are going to back down. And actually, I'm not even too convinced that the Chinese are particular. I think they would rather have Trump there than not have Trump there. I mean, Trump has been on overall, I think, good for China. Because
which regrettably the American voters are not seeing.
No. I think the Chinese, they're not taking a 5-year view on this. They're taking a 25-year view where they're going, well, you know, a quarter of a century from now, people are going to look back and they're going to say that's when America lost it. And so, you know, having 8 years of Trump is better than having 4 years. So just because you have a, you know, sane person in power doesn't necessarily mean that the Chinese themselves will back down. There are a lot of bridges that have already been burnt. And that, you know, and actually interesting, one bridge was actually the Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei CFO. And what I think what happened with that one thing was that the Chinese population at large used to be actually relatively pro-US. You know, they looked up to the U.S. And that one instant, which had zero economic, you know, GDP-type impact, that one instant, I think, changed the perception of the entire population on the U.S. And you know, these things trickle down. The Chinese, if they can, you know, to have America as a rallying point is fantastic. But it just happened that in the past, you know, Chinese would, you know, I'm talking middle class Chinese and, you know, people I hang out with, would be quite you know, they aspire, they admire what America's managed to do, and now that I think that's gone, so the trigger points can be very subtle. On the tech war, to answer what I think about the tech war, is that there will be a decoupling between Chinese tech and Western tech, at least definitely American tech, and quite possibly Western, including European tech. And it will focus much more on Asia. Not necessarily, it doesn't have to all go back to China. Actually, China considers like Taiwan a very reliable partner when it comes to tech. And so, you know, Taiwan, Korea, all these countries, they feel, you know, much closer to. And like the new Huawei phone, for example, has zero Western tech in there. Huawei has, I was just at the factory, you know, very impressive. And they have, a whole set of new chips that they're doing. And it's not just chips. It's also the entire ecosystem of, because you need, you know, the software, you need the apps, you need a lot of other things that go with it. And so, you know, that's going to be a long-term thing. But you know, there are other things where they just simply cannot decouple. So there were, you know, for example, actually Wuhan is a big manufacturer of fiber optics. Inside these fiber optics is a chip made in America. It could have been made somewhere else, but it just happens to be made in America. So actually, the American telecom guys were were absolutely terrified at this whole export ban because they needed the Chinese-made fibers, but those Chinese-made fibers, if they couldn't get the chips from America, would be doomed. So there was this, you know, so it's so intricately woven that it would be very difficult to have any serious kind of long-term. So which is why I think it would be waged, and then they will not try it for another long time because it would be so painful, and they'll realize it's actually doesn't go anywhere. But, you know, a lot of, as I said, the bridges are being burnt. You know, the students are being sent back. The Chinese are going to look elsewhere, and once they get, you know, once they go on that trajectory, it's very hard to then get them back because hard to change tracks on these things.
Very well. Thank you very much. We have about 15 minutes. And I would not want us up here to monopolize all discussion and questions. So this gentleman right here has a question.
Sure. So I think with the state-owned enterprises, like the approach in the 90s was to liberalize them. And as you alluded to, that resulted in a lot of like mass layoffs in the 90s. But I think under Xi Jinping, the overall effect has been to merge the state-owned enterprises to resolve some of the excess capacity. Do you have any thoughts or comments on that?
Well, that's why SOE reform a few pages back.
Nice.
At SOE reform in the middle, because it used to be here, and then it's here, so it's kind of a little bit in the middle. Absolutely, that's been a very clear trend, and it's been mostly under Xi Jinping. He's actually he ended a lot of the, I personally think, good work that was done in the 90s to foster competition, to foster... you know, to increase the level, the game of these guys, and that's going to be very difficult to see going anywhere else in the short term. That said, you know, these things will flip. They continue to flip back. You know, state-owned enterprises, by virtue of being state-owned, actually have a lot of benefits that Xi Jinping is using to help the economy right now. You know, you have a 1.5% cost of capital, basically. They don't have any expectations for having any major returns, so they can bid for deals and make very little money. Thereby, in an economy where your asset prices are not rising that fast, by reducing your cost, you actually can deliver profits. So, definitely trend in the short term. I think longer term it will have to go the other way, because this is not the right way that to reach, you know. China will end up in the middle-income trap if it continues this way.
Yes?
This is a bit of a selfish question from me. But since you are so knowledgeable to Chinese geopolitics, how do you think these reforms will affect the current increased investment interest in Africa? You know, Chinese...
Chinese, they're... will increasingly be interested in Africa, and you know, the Chinese have friendly countries and less friendly countries, but by and large, I mean, they're very strong in Africa, and you know, partly because, you know, the West just wasn't very good. You know, they could fly in and give a better offering. They offered something better to. You know, is it better long term? Really, who knows? But. No, definitely Africa is very central to Chinese. Absolutely, even more so, I think, even more so going forward. And, you know, I was just recently in Changsha, which is Hunan province. It's, you know, one of these middle provinces, which, you know, great place, but really not a place I would have expected to have huge, like, China-Africa conference. And it was plastered all over, it was a big thing, and you know, so yes, definitely very interested. Not very knowledgeable, but very interested.
Are events like the crisis in Hong Kong likely to shape Chinese policy in the future?
Not likely, I don't think. It will shape Chinese policy towards Hong Kong, definitely, but it wouldn't shape Chinese policy overall.
Yes, back there.
First of all, thank you so much for being here and
fascinating presentation.
Thank you.
So you said there will be a lot of economic reform coming, definitely, and C-scheme technical term will keep the policy somewhat stable. What do you think of the social reforms? Would that play any significant role or even disturbing role at all?
You know, the impressive thing about China, two things, I think. First, of course, they, and everyone knows that, they you know, got 800 million people out of poverty. But the, I think even more impressive than that was that they got 150 million people out of poverty in the last 10 years. Is that they didn't stop at, you know, when they reached okay level, let's just stop doing this anti-poverty work. They continued doing it. And, you know, now the aim is, you know, zero poverty this year. And by the way, it's not funky accounting, which, you know, some people, they use higher standards of accounting poverty. So I'd say, you know, society, that's number one thing. That said, to get China to the next level, you need much more difficult things from the government. And difficult, like, you know, hukou, which is this registration of your where you live, hukou reform, massive difficulty. It's like it's been attempted for 30 years, but you need that if you're going to actually get to the next level. You also need the safety net to be better. Hu Jintao had attempted it in his first term, and it didn't really go anywhere. You also have, you know, the hospitals and healthcare, and, you know, all these big things which you will need, and you know, all that in light of an aging population. And let's not forget, we have a government which is increasingly paranoid. So a lot of social reforms need paranoid and also inert. They don't like doing stuff. So a lot of these social reforms are very difficult social reforms. It's going to take a lot of courage, and you don't have a lot of courage going around right now for good reason.
We're going to take two so that we can pile them up a little bit. There's one here in front, two in the back, and then we will give our guest the last word.
Thanks very much for this evening, for the lecture. Is very interesting in all aspects. You specifically mentioned trade wars and the US's sort of not being a stable partner, and seven parts of Southeast Asia, Thailand being one. I wondered what you think of regional trading blocs such as ASEAN and CPTPP in that whole geopolitical upheaval and the decline of the US and the rise of China as well.
Shall we just take all three and then...
Yeah.
There are two hands in the back there. There we go. Thank you.
On climate change and kind of thinking about the need, the fear of financial crisis and the need for growth and balancing that against China's interest in taking on a global leadership role into the far future, do you see what is the view in China on taking up the role that the US has kind of retreated from globally?
I'm wondering what do you think are the effects of the recent Taiwanese election on Chinese foreign policy?
In terms of, why don't I start with Taiwan, because that one's easiest. I think that there was a lot of thinking going on, why did she win, but why did she win so much, given that she was so far behind? And, you know, they attributed it, I think rightly, to what happened in Hong Kong. And so that's an easy answer. And there might have been a lot of other things, but this meteoric rise from 20% popularity rate less than a year ago to landslide election win, definitely Hong Kong played a role. So I don't think it's particularly. I think the way they view Taiwan is, why can she not love me? I give her everything. Why can she not love me? In terms of ASEAN, If ASEAN could work, it would be a fantastic counterbalance to these two big giants that are kind of playing in ASEAN's backyard, right? I mean, it just so happens we happen to be in that area. And unfortunately, it's just not happening yet. But I necessity will lead to creation. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that that it will. And especially because the necessity is this decline, this unreliability of the U.S. Lack of reliability, climate change. It's a little bit of a more complex issue. Climate change actually very much is a front central issue for China, and they, it's not that they want, they have taken the lead from America in terms of where's my NPL page? They have taken the lead from America because America dropped the ball, actually. That said, it will, the moves that they make very much depend on NPLs. The higher the NPL, the riskier the banking sector, because any of these, we're talking 30-year solutions, but if the banks fail tomorrow, that's not going to be very helpful. So environmental changes have led to an increase in non-performing loans. And if it gets to a point where it becomes systemic, the Chinese will lift the foot on the pedal. So they're going to go slower. And so the important thing is to actually, I monitor, regardless of who my client is, this is something I update every month, and I give them an update every month, where the NPLs are. You can be a hospital, I tell you what the NPLs are. You can be a bank, of course a bank matters, but a construction company. This affects nearly everything, because it gives you the bandwidth with which the Chinese government can play with on any issue. Especially climate change is one of the big ones. And climate change is very strong, they're very committed. And that's the reason why I actually I made one of the examples, environment. And it's one of the top three priorities of the government right now, environment. So, they couldn't be strong. But their ability, their bandwidth that they have with which to play is very much limited by how bad the banks are.
We have 5 minutes. I'm going to take the liberty of asking one last question. You talked about, in passing, you mentioned the phrase middle-income trap. In my mind, at least, middle-income traps come not from some built-in financial or economic dynamic. Middle-income traps come from the fact that the politics gets all screwed up. The two classic examples of middle-income traps in the world are a country called Greece and a country called Argentina. And I'm not being arbitrary here. If you look at the World Bank classifications, they are the only two countries that entered upper middle income and never left upper middle income. Okay? They never became upper income. At least haven't yet. And I suspect they won't in the next few years. And it is not unfair to say that the politics probably is what really spoil things. But these are democratic systems. These are messy democratic systems in which there's a lot of contestation. And the contestation is good for freedom, but sometimes it is bad for policy stability or the quality of policies. China is a very different cup of tea. It is not a democracy. It is not a country in which there's a lot of open contestation. And it is a country in which economic policy making has been actually pretty good, at least at the micro level, mostly, and the macro level most of the time, not always. So for China to enter, an upper middle income, get stuck, kind of trap, the politics will really have to go south. Mm-hmm. Is that the sort of story that you have in the back of your mind?
I think we mustn't assume that it can't, just because it's not democratic. The country is not democratic, but the party itself actually is quite a bit more democratic. It's one man, one vote. You have actually. I was with Apisit Vechachiwa, who was at the time head of the opposition, He then later became a prime minister. But I was with him in China at the invitation of the Communist Party. And he, you know, we were discussing, it was a heart-to-heart, party-to-party, party-leader-to-party leader, about, you know, problems that the Democrat Party in Thailand was having and the Communist Party in China was having. And the Chinese were going like, yeah, you know, we need to figure out how to, you know, attract all these young, you know, Silicon Valley returnees to join the party. We want them to join the party. We don't know how to do that. And then another thing we're having is that we have this bad thing about vote buying in the party. You know, there's vote buying, and we got to figure out how to stomp it out. And then later in the car, Apisit turned to me and he said, well, if they're buying votes, it must be democratic then. And it's true. You wouldn't bother to buy a vote if the vote wasn't worth anything. And so,
although to know if they're truly democratic, we'd have to know the price of a vote. No,
the prices were there. And so the I think the just because the country itself is the party can get very dysfunctional within itself, and it's the party is democratic. I think, you know, I think, but it's not a great democracy. It's not a democracy where the cliques and clans, they're different cliques and clans, but they're not policy driven. So there's no policy competition between the Shanghai clique and the Princelings and the Youth League clique and all. It's all like which clan I belong to. It's tribal. It's not like, oh, we believe in free market, and the other one's, oh, we're left wing.
Of course, looking at American or British or European politics, we see some resemblance there, right?
But actually,
mostly about tribes nowadays.
Yes,
everywhere.
That is true. Except for when it comes to China, interestingly. Everyone in America, you know, so China not only unites the countries of the world, it also unites America, the Democrats and the Republicans, in a way that has never happened. But I think the issue that we can get in China is actually this paucity of competition within policies that could lead to some really bizarre policy, and especially you layer onto that, you know, American aggression, and you layer onto that effectively a very nationalist population. You know, if you look at what they write on Weibo, it's crazy. Thank goodness they don't have to vote. Because they say, oh, let's attack Taiwan tomorrow, right? And you know, it's these guys, these gray-suited guys in the Politburo that are holding it back.
Well, but, you know, people say crazy stuff on social networks everywhere.
That's true, yeah.
China's not unique. Yeah.
But on that point, though, I think one thing that we've seen, and someone alluded to it earlier, is this lack of, you know, the SOEs coming back. We're also seeing within the party itself, there used to be 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this democratization of the party. There was a movement to improve the democracy within the party. It ain't happening anymore. And I believe one of the big reasons it's no longer happening is because, you know, those that they used to look up towards here, America, right, have failed. They've looked at it and they're going, actually, you know, in the 90s, there were 80s, 90s, they were looking up to these countries. And they were going like, wow, we need to, this is how we need to go. You know, Deng went to America and he was like, my gosh, this is how we need to get, this is how what we need to do. And then he had, at that time, the example of all these Asian countries in the 80s, right? So when he signed that Hong Kong agreement, you know, all these, he was thinking, well, look at all these countries in Asia, which are quote-unquote democratic, but where only one party has ever ruled. And I'm talking both about Japan, right? Japan, Malaysia, Thailand at the time was under military. We have Philippines, Indonesia, allegedly democratic and yet under one party. I think, you know, Deng was going, we can do this. This works. And then they saw, oh, democracy in America is good. And then slowly, one by one, they all fell in Asia, right? Only Singapore left now, you know. And they're going, well, okay, maybe that's not great. And, you know, I don't think they'll mind being democratic so long as they know they'll be in party. In power, right? And then, at the same time, the Americans and the Brits and a lot of Western, you know, very developed countries had the system that failed, and so that they perceived failed. And I think that's what's
talk about a spillover.
Yes.
Back politics in the U.S. and the U.K. spills over to a small country called China. not a very optimistic notes on which to end the lecture. But I do want to end on a more optimistic note. We are running out of time. If you are a parent, and of course most of you guys are not yet a parent, but you might be, you ought to be unbelievably impressed by the fact that Joe and Juan brought their two children who are sitting in the front row, and not only have they been reading, they haven't been reading screens, they've been reading books. So there are children in the world who, A, are well-behaved, and B, still read books, and I want to commend you for that. You are great parents, aside from being great guests. Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much.